Thank you.
Okay, so turning to agenda papers 5. We have 3 papers for the board today, plus the cover note, which is basically updated and rolled forward from the cover note, in February's meeting. And as agreed last meeting, we're focusing on the Gamma approach this meeting. Now, apart from agenda paper 5C, the papers we will be discussing at this meeting follow on from our discussions in that February meeting, but I just want to start with agenda paper 5C because it continues the theme of the feedback on the agenda consultation. It's presented for information only. And I just wanted to highlight a few of the points that came out of the agenda consultation regarding the FICE project. More than half of the respondents to the agenda consultation mentioned the FICE project, and most of those rated the project as either high or medium in terms of importance. There were some that, or a few that, rated it low, mostly preparers, and the reasons for that was perhaps because they weren't really affected by liability and equity problems, or they didn't think that we'd be able to reach a conclusion in a short time frame. But apart from that, looking across the geographies and the types of respondents, it was fairly well supported. However, there was one notable absence, and that was the user response to the agenda consultation and the online survey, which did not mention the FICE project specifically, and they did not rate the importance of the FICE project specifically. However, they did raise topics that we are investigating as part of this project. So my take on this is that it just indicates that there was insufficient information provided in the document about what it is we're exploring and the scope of the issues. And so we might need to do a bit more work in communicating what the scope of the project is. Finally, just as a side note, the FASB is going to, as part of its agenda consultation, ask whether it should do more work on liabilities and equity. It's not clear exactly what the scope of that work would be, but it's going to ask the question in its agenda consultation. So we'll continue to monitor that. Did anyone have any comments or questions on the agenda consultation feedback before we move on to the other papers?
Can I just say that the users, when they were asked to name their top topics, didn't specifically mention FICE because I think it's not a term they use. But when they were asked to just click on a box and say, for these projects, do you think it's high, medium, or low important, 24 thought it was high important, 25 thought it was medium, 11 thought it was low, and 9 thought it was no opinion. So in fact, 69 users did comment in the tick box part of the survey, not in the free format part of the survey. So it was the fourth highest user response.
Did anyone have any questions or comments on the cover notes?
One comment may I on that the future meetings, future topics, that's a paragraph 38C on equity instrument. So.
Sorry, yes? Yep.
Yeah.
38C of agenda paper 5?
Yes.
Yep.
38 and C, recognition, derecognition, the reclassification of equity. After, so there, what is the objective of this part?
So this is what we're going to discuss in agenda paper 5B is the attribution of profit or loss to classes of equity instruments. if we are going to be doing some attribution and we are going to be doing some accounting for equity instruments, this is going to be some new requirements that we're going to be introducing. And to go along with that, we're going to need to have some requirements to do some other accounting for equity instruments within equity, including things like on initial recognition, how do we recognize things in particular classes, what we do on settlement, what we do on conversion. And the reason why this is a topic is, for example, when we talk in the future about non-controlling puts and non-controlling interests, a lot of the issues that came up at IFRIC wasn't just to do with whether the liability for puts written on non-controlling interest should be net or gross. It was also if you do recognize the gross liability, how do you do the accounting within equity to account for that transaction? What is left within equity? What does that represent? And part of this is going to be trying to clarify those requirements. And we also talked about the status of the project at the last ASAP meeting, and we simply updated them on status, and we just asked them for potential topics for future discussion at the ASAP, and they gave us three or four topics that we might bring back to them, including share settlement. Whether that should meet the definition of a liability, and the application of the present obligation requirements that we're developing as part of the conceptual framework, which we talked about in the previous conceptual framework session. Any other questions or comments? No? Okay. So should we move on to agenda paper 5A? Oh, sorry. This is Daisy Yang. She's joined the sorry, Daisy.
It's your first time at the table.
First time at the table, yeah.
She's Australian man. She'll be gone.
She's going to... all the difficult questions, please direct at her and leave me out of it.
Put two of these together.
Yeah. It compounds the problem, doesn't it? Agenda paper 5A. So in February, we discussed potential separate presentation requirements for those obligations that would be classified as liabilities under the Gamma approach that would require the transfer of resources, but the amount of the obligation is somehow linked to the residual amount, for instance, linked to an entity's ordinary shares. At that time, we just limited our discussion to ordinary shares that... to puttable ordinary shares that would be classified as liabilities, so that did not meet the exception for puttable instruments in IS 32. In this paper, what we're doing is we're just thinking about whether we should apply the separate presentation requirements to other liabilities that might share those features. And we also consider how such requirements might interact with the existing classification requirements in IFRS 9. Just in terms of scope of the paper, we didn't get into detail about what we exactly mean about the residual amounts. We are asking whether the separate presentation requirements should apply to some liabilities, assuming that they do have that feature. We also assume that, for instance, an instrument that meets the fixed-for-fixed condition would meet that requirement. In a future meeting, we plan on bringing that question back to the board to refine in more detail what we mean by a residual amount and to reconsider the fixed-for-fixed condition in that context. However, we think that it might help to consider some of the more complex issues around that, such as foreign currency convertibles, once we have a better idea about what tools might be available to address some of those more complex instruments and whether we might be applying that concept to classification within liabilities or just to classification of liabilities and equity. We also stepped back a bit from the debate about whether the separate presentation requirements would apply within profit or loss or using profit and loss or OCI, and so we've just called them separate presentation requirements. The board is going to be continuing its discussion of P&L and OCI as part of the conceptual framework project, and we'll just monitor those developments and see whether we need to make any changes to the analysis, and we'll bring that back again for a preliminary review at a future meeting. Okay, so just going through the analysis in the paper, it's from paragraphs 13 to 23. Our first step was really just to see, under the existing requirements of IFRS 9, how those classification requirements apply, which instruments might be potential candidates for the separate presentation requirements. Under IFRS 9 in general, an entity classifies its liabilities as at amortized cost unless IFRS 9 requires or permits them to be classified at fair value. We came to the conclusion that the relevant instruments that might be candidates for the separate presentation requirements would include standalone derivatives and non-derivatives that include an embedded derivative that has a feature that is dependent on the residual amount, and which both instruments would be classified as at fair value through profit or loss. Now, for liabilities that depend on the residual amount, we're only interested in separately presenting those changes that result from changes in the residual amount. We don't really want to separately present changes in the fair value that result from other variables. So it's a question of isolating those out. For standalone derivatives, assuming we conclude that the derivative depends on the residual amount, so, for example, it meets the fixed condition. We asked the board whether the separate presentation requirements should apply to those derivatives. If the board thinks that they should, then a challenge arises when we look at financial liabilities that include the embedded. Now, this is because IFRS 9 does not require the separation of the embedded derivatives. It allows the entity to classify the instrument as a whole at fair value through profit or loss, which means it includes not only the changes in the residual amount, but also other changes. So we came up with two approaches to addressing this challenge. And approach A would require the entity to separate out that embedded derivative that depends on the residual in order to account for that on a comparable basis with the standalone derivatives. Approach B would continue the fair value option, but the downside of that is the instrument as a whole would be classified at fair and measured at fair value. However, we wouldn't apply the separate presentation requirements to that instrument, and so there would be a slight loss in comparability. So it comes down to a question of the benefits and costs of separating out the embedded if you decide that you want to apply the separate presentation requirements to derivatives that have this feature. Okay.
So,
questions and comments?
Questions and comments. So on the standalone derivatives, first of all, while I understand the sort of presentation objectives that you're trying to achieve, I think the risk with this is that it will fast becoming quite complicated, because if I have a situation where I've got a relatively simple derivative that's purely along the lines of the ones you've described in the paper that are very much, you know, delta one, if you like, type instruments, then I think it's quite simple to understand. But I think if you're talking about standalone derivatives, so this is any cash-settled derivative potentially, they could be complicated derivatives that have got multiple drivers. And I think we'll then have a question about whether or not you then have to sort of start bifurcating derivatives, so the bit that's really to do with the residual is separated out and the other bit's left behind, or whether, you know, how much of a residual link does there have to be before you get stuck into this requirement or not. And I think it'll be hard to be too pure about it and it will get complicated. So I'm not sure if the benefits are really justified. The other thing on the standalone derivatives is that, and I know that you've sort of parked the where is it separately presented question in this paper, but it matters to me, I think, because I'd probably be more willing to consider separate presentation within P&L, because if we start to talk about separate presentation in OCI and we're talking about standalone derivatives, I think this will be the first time where we'd allow remeasurement of derivatives to be outside P&L. Because even in the own credit requirements, we're very specific that if there's embedded derivatives, they have to be measured fully at fair value through P&L. And it's only the sort of host that has the own credit trigger. So that would be my observation on the standalone derivatives. If we were to go down this path, though, and then we had to make a decision about approach A versus approach B for the hybrid type instruments, my preference would be to go with approach A in that situation. And the reason why my preference would be for approach A in that situation would be, I think lots of people, including lots of sophisticated preparers who are probably the more likely ones to have these complicated types of instruments, choose the fair value option today because they've had their fingers burnt with the complexity of bifurcation, with restatements, etc. So they choose to avoid the whole complexity of bifurcation by using the fair value option. And we'd sort of be undoing their ability to make those decisions if we said they had to bifurcate for derivatives that had these types of features. So I think approach A, but I'm not too keen, I'm afraid.
Just on the derivatives, standalone derivatives, would you classify standalone derivatives as equity if they meet the fixed condition?
Yes.
So this one would only apply
fixed for fixed, but these can be any cash settled derivative that's got a link, some sort of link to your residual amount.
Yeah, but assuming we keep fixed for fixed, for instance, and we apply a similar requirement to classify equity instruments, to distinguish between liabilities and equity, you'd get the equivalent instrument if you didn't have the cash settlement requirement to be classified as equity. And I was just thinking, if the only difference is the cash settlement.
Sure, but then what would you say? If it would be equity settled, if it was but for the cash feature,
yeah,
that would be better.
Yeah. That's kind of the thing that I was trying to achieve.
Can I ask a question as to why you think the separation presentation purposes of these derivatives is any more complex than the decision we made to separate the credit risk component of a movement in a financial instrument?
Well, this would be it would be the first time we've ever bifurcated a derivative that I can think of.
Yep.
We've never done that before. Secondly, on own credit, we came up with a very ish sort of method that we'll accept that's very simplistic and not terribly pure. So I guess we could do something similar, but you know, it just adds layers of complexity. Because we took a simple approach with the own credit and said you can measure it this way, even though we know it's very, but you know, approximate.
Can I also ask you a quick question?
Ask me.
given I think that this residual sometimes produces what some companies would consider a counterintuitive impact, there may well be an interest from the companies themselves in presenting it separately, in other words, in isolating it. Would you allow approach B?
Steph can answer.
Well, I think under approach A, what that would mean is you'd still have the fair value option. And if they apply the fair value option, then they don't get the separate presentation requirements. But that still means that if they didn't apply the fair value option, then if they separated the embedded derivative out, then they would apply it to that separated embedded derivative.
I think that is only to the extent that we assume that it's always a whole derivative that we're talking about in each of the circumstances, given the argument Sue's just raised.
Yeah, well,
the question is to Sue rather than to you guys.
So if they do the separation, so in approach B, for instance, where they're required to do the separation, they'd have to do the separation in a very particular way.
It leads to the odd circumstance where, depending on one option that you can make, which is whether you unbundle or not, and then a second issue, whether you have a whole derivative or partial derivative, you're going to get different presentation outcomes.
I think I guess I'd still question cost benefit, because I would have thought that most of the, if we've heard concerns in this area, it's, and this is forgetting the investor perspective for a while, so it's something I don't know yet. But if you look at the preparer side, I think it's tended to be more to do with, you know, the NCI put type scenario. And I wonder whether we could solve most of the concerns by having a narrower focus without going to the complexity of what this all brings in. It means we wouldn't have the information, which I think Manuel, in a perfect world, would like us to be able to present. But
the one point that we haven't addressed here is if all of these changes are in P&L, you might argue, who cares, right? Because whether they're all aggregated or they're separated, one might say, I don't really care. But if you start separating and putting something in OCI, well, then now you got something that might drive a lot of people's opinions on this. So, you know, the complexity issue, yeah, you're right. But until that other part of the question, which hasn't been asked here, is answered, it might be difficult to answer that question. You just said separation. You didn't say, and
but,
where.
But from, I guess, looking at the needs of users and investors, I mean, we have in the past received comments that anything that has potential upside in the entity, for instance, they'd like to know the effect of those types of instruments. And I guess that's where this whole beta approach came from, because we want to separate out the value changes that are linked to the performance of the entity from other value changes that are independent. And it's just at least having that separation would be beneficial, I think, to users of financial statements. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it's the cost versus benefit of doing that separation. I mean, what we're proposing is we just include a discussion in the discussion paper. We get some more information as part of the exposure and consultation about what the benefits and costs really are. We might, if when we present this to investors, I mean, because they've asked for some kind of information like this, we'd ask them whether this really meets their needs. Do they really want this information? Preparers have said it's going to cost them a lot. Does the benefit of this information exceed the cost? And then we can have a debate about the benefits and costs.
And you are, just to remind, you add to your observation, you are proposing having both in the discussion paper, so we'll have the chance to hear both sides.
Yeah.
Stephen?
The problem at the moment is that this area is highly complex for investors, so I understand concerns about complexity for preparers and doing this type of bifurcation, but it is very difficult for investors to really understand performance when these types of instruments are affecting the P&L, and it's difficult to disentangle what is the cost of that instrument from what is the impact of the residual. And the NCI puts is a very good example, and there are relatively small number of companies, many of them in Europe, that have a big impact of the NCI puts on our income statement, and it's relatively transparent and people can understand it. But when you come to these other instruments, it becomes more and more difficult to really understand what the impact is. I mean, if they're not material, fine, they're not material, we don't deal with it. But if they are material and they have an impact on your understanding of the P&L, then it creates this complexity for the investor. So I'm very supportive of doing what we can here. I would be supportive of approach B. I know it will add complexity, but the objective of trying to understand the impact of the change in the residual on the performance measures for the period, I think, is a really good objective, and we should do our best to find a way of making it operational.
So you want to go back in?
And I don't necessarily object to, I don't object at all to it being in the discussion paper. I just want us to have hummed enough bars on it that people don't come back and say, don't be stupid.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What the heck does residual mean if I've got something with multiple layers? So I think we need to have developed it, not in the nth degree, but in enough detail that we don't, that we look like we've understood what the issues and complexity might be to get informed feedback as much as possible. The other thing I would want to, in that sort of spirit, highlight an approach B, would be that I think you could end up in theory with a situation where you would bifurcate. a derivative which is linked to the residual amount and then end up with a derivative that's not linked to the residual amount in the host, and it'll be a question of whether the fair value option can then apply to the bit that's left. There's going to be lots of layers of questions.
Just to come back to, yes, for the second question, you could very easily, I think I have personally seen instances of instruments where one of the embedded is residual, and then you end up with what I would again call a hybrid, which has an embedded, or whether you can do the fair value option. I think that's a tweak we do need to consider. Regarding approach A, I think one of the things which personally, it is an option, Darrell, so if somebody wants to use the fair value option, it's always optional on an instrument by instrument case. So if they want to use the fair value option, then they do so consciously and give up what you say is the big advantage of presenting this in a different part of the financial statements. I think the challenge, both on the purity of what we are trying to capture, comes in with the derivatives which are dual indexed. So it's got equity, and the biggest example which I've come across is foreign currency convertible bonds, where the foreign currency, foreign conversion option might have a very high amount of equity or residual movement, but has got a foreign currency element which vitiates that. One of the things I absolutely agree, and we will explore it, because these are challenges we will have to cover whichever track we go if we want to present it out, is splitting a derivative, and for my sins and also shows my age, I've done this in front of IFRIC, is quite a challenging task because you have to do the hypothetical legs in there, and that's where it becomes quite challenging. So I fully am cognizant with what Sue has said, that we do need to explore what is the meaning of residual, and secondly, to quite an extent, what will be the mechanics of how we go about doing it. But the point I'm trying to make is I think there is quite a bit of benefit in exploring that, Sue, because this is one of the biggest challenges I think we face in front of IFRIC and also conceptually to delineate what is the performance that we are trying to demonstrate.
Changu?
Thank you. Very simple question rather than a sophisticated one.
I'm not good at the financial instrument,
but just it's not easy to understand what you described here. Paragraph 34. In the case of a written warrant, you are saying the written forward and written warrants are different in terms of time value of money. The time value option.
Yeah.
So there, if you, you said that the second sentence, therefore, the change in the fair value of the warrant will not be the same as the change in the underlying ordinary shares, like the forward contract that before. However, the change in the time value of the option would still be driven by the residual amount. So that your conclusion is this written word still you can be.
Yeah.
Separated, presentable, you know, on the balance sheet and the income statement.
So the written warrant, similar to just the cash settled one, similar to a warrant that would be physically settled with shares, would represent a residual interest, similar to the equity classified warrant. Yeah, and based on that, simply because it's cash settled. We would come to the same conclusion that it depends on the residual amount. That's just a technical point about the fact that the changes in the warrant, even though they might include the time value component, not just the intrinsic value, but that time value component is still going to be affected by the risk in the residual. I mean, the factors that drive the value are going to be the factors that come from the residual amount and changes in the residual amount.
Not the whole amount of time value of option, but some part of the time value of option depends on that underlying.
That's right. Yeah.
So as Steve said, if we separate present these changes on the balance sheet and the income statement, then if we see the some amount in the income statement, then amount might be kind of a contaminated with the two different returns.
No. It will be the same return. It's just for the warrant. It's going to be compounded in a way that the forward is not.
Mm.
Yeah. It's going to be leveraged in a. It will be slightly more leveraged than the forward contract. Yeah.
Mary?
In response to the questions you've put here, I do want to explore in a discussion paper this notion of separation. In the early days of my learning curve, I am more with approach A, but I do think we should explore both to get information about them. I do have a bit of, and it's maybe me oversimplifying, a bit of a different communication way to think about what we're trying to achieve, at least for the approach A. Stepping all the way back when you started to take us walking slowly through alpha, beta, and gamma. Alpha is basically solvency. Beta,
liquidity.
Yes, liquidity, beta, solvency. And I recognize that there are complex instruments that have characteristics of both, and not trying to pretend otherwise. But we ended up saying, let's take gamma, which says you qualify as liability if you have either characteristic. You may doubly qualify by having both. And I think what we're trying to say here, I look at least approach A as saying, if you're qualifying for liability because you only have alpha characteristics, this is classified as a liability because there could be a required outflow of cash or other resources because somebody can put this share to you, but it's for an amount that depends on the residual. So I look at this rather than being neutral and saying X characteristics, I say, having made the gamma a combined test, I think we're now trying to think about whether separate presentation is dependent on filtering out the alpha-only items. And that doesn't mean the alpha portion of items. This is why I think I get I'm more approach A. It isn't the alpha portion. Figure out what piece of the movement in some big blob is related to the change in the value of the residual. It's saying, if you got caught in liability only because you have alpha characteristics, dependent on the residual, then think about separating the presentation of that change in value. And if that's how I think about it, then at the risk of incurring Sue's wrath, I am willing, at least in these early stages, to explore how far apart can the separate presentation be, which is a coded way of saying, even think about the radical idea of in OCI. But to me, it's this, because you got caught only because you have alpha.
Yeah. It comes down to the same question, though, about what we mean by, for instance, only because it's alpha, what we mean by what beta is, what the residual amount is, etc.
It still is dependent. We would have to build up what it is,
do a bit more work
definition
on that,
of residual, etc. But I think we should figure out whether or not this thing has legs, before we invest a lot of time in trying to define residual, because if we aren't going to make a distinction based on that, why invest a lot of time in figuring filtering that definition?
Martin.
Yep. 2 points. My first, wouldn't it be better if before we proposing that in the DP that we maybe find out how difficult it really is for derivatives which have an element which is then really based on the value is based on really the residual and maybe other elements, because man, in all other projects we are going away from that, because man, we in insurance we saying it's too difficult to come up with what is a guarantee, what is other, what is features, and here we going the opposite direction. Also in IFRS 9 for the asset side, we are going away from this splitting between, okay, what is maybe an embedded derivative, what is maybe the host, and saying, okay, everything with fair value. And when I'm not an expert in that, but I can imagine it is very, very difficult to find it out. Secondly, the question is, when it relates to paragraph 35.b, what is then the benefit of doing that? Isn't that to separate that element in the P&L? Or would we say, because we have this problem with 35B and compared with also with our own credit risk, that okay, it is a counterintuitive P&L, because if the value of the company is increasing, you're showing an expense. And maybe is that in the next step that we would propose that should go also in OCI's element, or?
I think that's what
is that open?
That's what we'll have to bring back at some point. At the present, we're just considering both options, keeping both options on the table.
That is my third question. What is really the value then for investor? Instead of saying, okay, we have a number of derivatives which are saying the value is depending on the residual and giving this kind of disclosure information instead of have this complicated splitting up fair values of derivatives. What is really the value? That is my point. Is it the information need to get information as an investor saying, okay, that is the kind of exposure which the company has on the liability side where the value can change with the value of the company, or is it really that they need the information, what is the P&L impact on that? That is really what I'm struggling with.
I think the latter, no?
I think so. I think.
But why? But that is my question. Why is that so important?
Because I think they need to distinguish between the drivers of, because the performance of the
But is that performance? That is my, was my second question. Is that really performance?
Well, I was about to say I shouldn't use performance, but for instance, the return on its assets and the changes in other claims, which change independently of those assets, are going to affect that amount.
And I need a better understanding. What is really then, because I'm struggling with that argument. I don't really understand that. Why is that so important? What is it? Why is it?
Because they want to know how much, for instance, they need to, if they're assessing the prospects for future cash flows of the entity, they need to know the different pieces to make to determine how much cash is going to end up being.
But if they can estimate based, if that value is, maybe they can fall, look at what is it, maybe is a 5-10 years term and say, okay, what is the value of this company in 10 years? And do you think that then they can better make an estimate because they have the P&L number from the current? I don't think so. But maybe these guys can do that, but I would question that.
It's mainly about current period performance. It's not about forecasting the future, because the fair value of the claim is what you need for that. It's
but
understanding current period performance and what's sustainable, what's not, management influence, what's the influence by the market. It's, I know we don't know what performance is, but
but going back, Martin, were you speaking more broadly than about a broader population than the population that Manuel was raising? Because I thought, first of all, when we looked at this, I had to remind myself that we separate only for liabilities, not for assets. And that, so we're in the category of liabilities to begin with. And I think that at least approach A, and I have to go back and look again at approach B, is saying, we're not trying for every instrument to isolate the portion of the total change that is due to the dependency on change in the value of a residual, but rather, at least approach A is saying, if you have an instrument that is accounted for separately, and the reason there's a change in the claim amount is only because of the change in the residual value, then at least approach A is saying, consider separating out those and presenting the change in their value separately, rather than going through and finding for every instrument that has a piece that fluctuates based on residual, what the piece is and pulling that out. And so I think approach A at least is a much more restricted one. And sorry, I put my flag up for a different reason, which is when I was going through and answering your questions and you said, is there any other approach that the board thinks we should explore? I think going back to Sue's original comment of this seems simple when we look at simple instruments, but it could get complex very fast. Would we achieve, you know, answer 80% of the problems, I'm putting words in her mouth, with a much more targeted answer, even if it doesn't achieve our objective of overarching principles to underpin 32? Should we focus on something more narrowly? We probably have to add a third alternative that is targeted guidance for particularly problematic categories.
Yeah.
I think just in terms of if we were to go to a DP, I think we probably have to ask that as a third approach.
At the last meeting, for instance, one of the clear candidates is the shares that are putable at fair value. Mm-hmm. And I think for those, that would capture the majority of the issues, I think. the question is do we want to, for the sake of comparability and consistency, do we really want to extend that much further? Now, the issue is you get
without
into
that articulating principle.
Yeah.
My question was to do with, just on that, because I think maybe relatedly, what I was going to check, but I think you confirmed it indirectly, or Mary said it and you didn't disagree, this is only on the liability side of the balance sheet. So if I had an asset where the amount that I was going to get varied depending on the performance of my own shares, this isn't in here. So if particularly you went with approach A, and because it's only on the liability side of the balance sheet, not the asset side, we'd be overselling it a bit to say that you were really getting a comprehensive picture about the effects of stuff going through your P&L, which is based on changes in your residual amount, right? Because it's to the extent that it's on the liability side, to the extent you haven't used the fair value option, that's...
Yeah, and the reason for that is because...
I just think we need to be clear what exactly picture would be that you'd be getting with the different alternatives.
Yeah.
This would also be so that you could have an embedded, which is an asset, which is the derivative.
That's what I'm saying. That wouldn't be taken out. I'm hoping I'm not going to rebifurcate assets after.
You have to understand the performance. Why we can focus only on the liability side, not on the asset side. Why is that?
The project's called FICE.
because...
Okay.
We split liabilities and equity, but we don't split assets in the same way. Yeah.
Hard enough on one side of the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Manuel, you mentioned shares putable at fair value as a problem, but surely there isn't a fair value change of putable at fair value.
Sorry, not the ones that do not meet the exception.
The mics are off.
Carry on now. Sorry. Just a clarification.
Yeah.
But your popular example is ordinary bond. No, ordinary share. No, sorry.
Ordinary share
redeemable at fair value.
Yeah.
Ordinary share redeemable at fair value.
Yes.
So we classify this as a liability.
Yes, under the gamma approach.
Under the gamma.
It would be classified as a liability because you have an obligation to pay the fair value of the share price.
So we are presenting separately only the change of the fair value of derivatives, not the whole.
No, sorry. Last month, we talked about the shares redeemable at fair value. Under the existing requirements of IFRS 9, if you have a share redeemable at fair value on demand, you're looking at the whole amount.
Yeah, so we are not changing IFRS 9.
And that was, we were all also considering that as well. We didn't want to introduce new requirements in addition to IFRS 9, so we're trying to use the existing requirements of IFRS 9 to accomplish some of this. And part of the challenge is going through those requirements, given the embedded derivatives and the fair value option. Yeah.
I'm not sure if we really need votes on the questions.
Unless anyone bought this, I didn't get any hints that they disagreed.
I thought Martin's suggestion that you explore whether, you know, if you can, the costs are, let's not ask constituents questions that we could have known that the costs are just prohibitive.
But having said that, if we do that, I think it's good just to present that conclusion in the discussion paper to say that we've considered it so that users understand that we took their views on into consideration.
Yeah.
Okay, should I move to agenda paper 5B now? So in February, we asked you whether it would be useful to have, this is a similar theme to what we've been discussing about additional presentation requirements, but this time within equity. We asked whether it would be useful to attribute profit or loss and other comprehensive income to classes of equity other than ordinary shares. As we mentioned in February, we think attribution will provide useful information. It would also alleviate the polarized consequences of the classification decisions. And as a reminder, the ISB suggested doing something similar in the conceptual framework discussion paper as part of an enhanced statement of changes in equity. So this was seen as a way of providing the same information as a narrow equity approach and meeting the needs of users who have consistently requested more information about items classified as equity. Now, the approach that we proposed in February was quite similar to what we proposed in the discussion paper. However, in addition to recognizing changes in the statement of changes in equity, we would also present the attribution similar to how we present the attribution of P&L and OCI to non-controlling interests and parent equity interests to help show the waterfall of returns amongst holders of claims against the entity. In Agenda Paper 5, what we do is we explore ways we might accomplish that in a bit more detail. In particular, we look at what amounts should be attributed for non-derivative and derivative instruments that are classified as equity. As we suggested in February, we started with the attribution requirements or the requirements in IAS 33 for earnings per share. And by doing so, we're not suggesting that we want to change IAS 33 or we're expanding the scope to IAS 33 or that the requirements have the same objective. However, given that IAS 33 does require some calculations for items within equity, we thought it would be useful just to see what those requirements are and see if we can leverage them for the purposes of what we're proposing. We're going to be considering the interaction of, you know, the FIAS project proposals and IAS 33 at some future time. As illustrated in paragraphs 18 to 20, IAS 33 has attribution requirements for non-derivative equity claims such as preference shares and participating instruments. However, the way IAS 33 presents the effect is by the effect of derivatives is not by changing the numerator of the EPS calculation, but by including or excluding it into presented EPS amounts, the basic EPS and the diluted EPS. So what we do is we explore three approaches the board could take for derivatives. Approach A is the do-nothing approach and would seek to resolve the problems through disclosure. So this disclosure we'll explore in a future meeting, but might include things such as terms of the instrument, strike prices, etc. Approach B attributes the amounts based on changes in the fair value of the derivatives. The benefit of this approach is that it will result in the same attribution as if the derivatives were classified as liabilities, and so it would meet those needs of users that said that they prefer a narrower definition of equity. It would also be consistent with how we illustrated the proposals in the conceptual framework discussion paper. Even though we didn't propose to measure them at fair value, we did illustrate them in that way. However, as we note in the paper, attributing based on fair value would amplify the kind of things that we were trying to alleviate in the previous paper about changes in attributing changes in these instruments that result from changes in the residual. So it brings about the same presentation problems that we considered last time. It's going to be below the line, so it's not going to affect profit or loss, total comprehensive income, but it will affect the measure of the net attribution to the ordinary shareholder. So what we did in Approach C is we tried a modification of that to alleviate that, and it requires an additional calculation, additional costs to modify the fair value-based attribution to take into account the fact that not all the assets are recognized and not all changes in assets and liabilities are recognized. And so it would alleviate some of those issues but still show some changes of the effect of the distribution of returns between different classes of equity. This modification brings about other challenges, and we explore some of the advantages and disadvantages. we suggest including, I guess, all three approaches in the discussion paper. The first question we ask is whether you think we do the attribution for non-derivatives in similar to how IS 33 does it. The next question is for the derivative equity instruments, do you think we should do some attribution, and whether you have a preference from either of the approaches, and whether we should include all the approaches in the discussion paper. So I'll turn it over now.
I really grappled with this paper, I have to say.
EPS.
One of my favourite topics. Firstly, on the non-derivative sort of equity instruments, I agree with that. I think that I can see that that could be helpful. I think there's something that's not really investigated in the paper that we need to just circle back on, which is non-derivatives that are bifurcated under IAS 32, so compound instruments. So I think we need to think about those and whether or not we want to follow or not with those. On derivatives, I struggled a lot. Why did I struggle? I think, firstly, I'm still, again, concerned about cost-benefit, whether or not we need to go this far, or whether approach A, combined with better disclosures, would give people more information and transparency about the sort of value transfers without going all the way to attribution. Because while you rightly point out that approach B and C doesn't really change P&L performance, et cetera, it will change things like basic earnings per share, which are key metrics that the market is obsessed by. So it matters a lot, I think. And I guess what I struggle with, if I look at approach B and approach C, I think they're sort of building on the sorts of ideas that we have today for attribution of things like non-controlling interests. But for me, the difference between this and what we do there is, if I look at a non-controlling interest, I'm actually taking what's in the income statement and saying, sort of based on my ownership interest today, how much of that would I be entitled to if everything was distributed versus what's entitled to my ordinary shareholders. What we're doing here is we're taking an approach B and C, it's different variants of taking the numbers that I've reported in net income and then attributing them to people based on fair value changes and not based on what their current entitlements are given the instruments that they hold. And for me, that's a little, I find that a tricky step in logic for me. I can see why some people might like the information, so I don't oppose it being in the discussion paper, because I think it gives a good basis for discussion with investors about whether or not they really want what they've been asking for when they see it in black and white. And if I had to sort of prioritise between approach B and approach C, I prefer approach C, because at least it's thinking about things in relative terms and taking the total net income and apportioning it, rather than potentially getting to a situation where all of the value changes to do with my derivatives could be driven by something that's not recognised in P&L at all, but then I have this big attribution effect from P&L and a sort of counter effect for my ordinary shareholders, which to me gives a very weird picture. So if I had to choose between my two disliked alternatives, I'd choose C.
Tuck?
Thank you. Yeah, on the same point that Sue raised, so earnings per share. So if you compare the approach B and C, so if you look at approach B, you use the fair value, and actually try to achieve what we are trying to achieve in the narrow equity approach. And in the narrow equity approach, what we are discussing is we would like to describe what is the amount of transfer of wealth. So transfer of wealth is transfer of wealth between the current shareholder and the hypothetical shareholder who holds the warrant. Suppose Philip holds warrant, I hold the ordinary share. So if we go to the approach A, which is ordinary one, I would have a 15 currency unit per share. However, if I go to the approach B, my basic earning per share is only 10. So then 5 belong to Philip, because Philip has a warrant and he gained 5,000 because the fair value of warrant increased by 5,000. And actually, this is the fact. So in order to describe what Philip gained from me is 5,000. So that in order to depict what he gained and what I lost, then current unit 10 per share means something.
However, when it goes to the, when we go to the approach C, it's going to be proportional. So proportional sounds moderate, so that it wouldn't happen extreme case. But the amount of 2,700 doesn't mean anything. This is not the amount what the Philippe gained. This is not really the amount what I lost. So proportionally, I lost 2,700 and 2.7 per share. So question is this the right answer or not? So that is really the point. I personally prefer approach B.
I think the problem with, I guess, approach B, and I kind of like it because fair value solves a lot of problems, but it exacerbates some of the counterintuitive, or it makes things appear counterintuitive, because I think if the value of the company goes up and we're presenting, for instance, the gain to Philippe of 5,000, that isn't really that you've lost 5,000. It might be the case that the share price has gone up of the entity, but that's not going to be reflected in the count in the financial statements. And this comes back to the constraint that we're operating under, because we're not recognizing and measuring all of the resources and claims of the entity, and so there has to be some residual claim which absorbs all of those differences. However, the question is, on a standalone basis, does the 5,000 or the change in the warrant provide information to users when they're assessing cash flows and making their valuations?
Aren't I sort of creating the problem that I'm trying to solve for NCI puts?
Well, the problem that we're
ironically?
Trying to
yes.
Yeah, the problem that we're trying to solve in Agenda Paper 5A.
We're creating in 5B.
That's like a secret.
Yeah, but we're.
We are both equity holders in that entity.
In that entity,
yeah. I mean, money, you lost money because different repartition, different sharing the interest. But let me, the entity has lost any money?
No.
Okay.
So it's just a transfer of wealth.
But approach B may result in the entity showing in reduction in total equity.
No.
It just allocates.
Well,
yeah, allocate.
Can equity become negative overall? Or is
no.
Well, it can overall, but
exactly.
It's not going to
not
be
because
from
of proportion.
It's not going to be from the attribution.
In approach C, I think it shows how what is the entity's equity is shared between us on a proportionate basis, which is maybe not the actual value in any case. But it seems to me that approach B has some strange elements because it can show negative equity.
I think negative equity can result when your liabilities exceed your assets. Okay.
Well,
but if
the
within
fair value, that, well, part of the liability will be at fair value, the assets will be at cost in that case. Or most of the assets will be at cost, not capturing the element of value that
what
is
we're
reflected
talking about
in this
Philippe,
value.
Sorry, but what we're talking about, Philippe, is within equity. Within equity, we're presenting the transfers.
If something is measured at fair value, based on assets which are at cost, but not at fair value, that amount of fair value might exceed the residual interest that I have in that entity. So I think we could have negative equity.
No, but
ordinary shareholders could be negative and others could be positive.
Yes.
But overall, it doesn't change the net amount recognized in the period. It's
so
just how you split it up.
Need to be a flaw in the measurement, in a way. Because the more I take out of equity to allocate the tax, the less is left to me. At some point, its value could exceed what is left to me. Hence, what happens?
Yes.
Is there a flaw in measurement? Or?
I guess you're saying, is there a flaw on the measurement of the class of equity that Philippe has versus the class of equity that Tak has? I think you're talking about there's a floor on the total amount, that's the amount determined in accordance with IFRS, but my assumption is there's no floor on the amount for individual subclasses of equity.
Right. So what's the meaning of me showing negative equity in that situation, whereas I do have an interest in those assets which are measured at cost and do not reflect the actual fair value of those assets? What's the information value of me showing negative equity, or the entity showing negative equity for me because it's not me? I will, in my books, as an equity holder, I will measure on a different basis.
But But I think that the negative equity problem we can't get away from, because at some point you could you might always have negative equity depending on the recognition and measurement requirements of IFRSs. I guess the point we're trying to communicate to investors is the differential claims of claim holders within equity. And the question is simply, you know, is that best provided through the fair value of some of these claims, such as derivatives? I mean, we're not fair valuing everything, so the non-derivative equity claims are not going to be applying fair value. But for the derivatives, we don't really have another measure. We haven't really identified a useful measurement basis in the past.
My reaction to that is by measuring one class of equity at fair value and not the other one, I think we are creating a distortion.
I think that's the confusion. You're not measuring the class of equity at fair value in B. It's an attribution.
Yeah.
And therefore it's positive for one group and a negative for the other. It doesn't change overall the equity.
Which means there is a flaw. It cannot become negative in total.
Equity.
No, sorry, I'm talking about it. We measure the class. So the warrant, for instance, would be measured at fair value because the changes would be...
That's more than an attribution.
C is an attribution, B is a measurement, direct measurement.
And B is a direct measurement.
Yeah.
So we're attributing the changes, but we're attributing based on the change in the fair value of the warrant.
So the carrying amount
would be fair value.
But you have an equal and offsetting change in the carrying value of the residual equity.
Yes.
Which is my point, that you're not actually changing the overall measurement of equity.
No,
I agree, but some elements of equity will be negative, maybe possibly, and some will be positive. The total will be what it was.
Yes. But I think what we're trying to show in the attribution, Philippe, is just how the distribution of returns is going to be different. At the moment, I think if you have, for instance, a company that's funded with 50% warrants and 50% ordinary shares, you wouldn't show any attribution other through the dilution of basic EPS.
I understand that. I'm just questioning what is the relevance of an information that shows some elements of equity at a negative value, because that's what's going to happen, when the actual fair value of its equity is positive.
But that's a general constraint that we have in accounting. We've always said that it's going to
be worse.
Well, maybe it's that if the company wrapped up today, Top would walk away with everything there is and you'd be left maybe with zero as opposed to having to pay something.
But I think this is a good point that we have to put to investors who have called for a narrow approach to equity. Because if you went down a narrow approach to equity, that would be precisely the result.
What would be precisely the result?
Because you'd be remeasuring it because it would be liability label on it.
So as soon as you put it would just be you'd put the liability label on it, but all of the measurement consequences would result in that.
It has the same effect as if everything except ordinary shares is measured.
Yeah.
Liability.
Precisely.
I think this has great benefit because you know it would provide the information of dilution effect of dilution. Suppose you have a shares and you think you have a good shares. And this company grown. And then I think I get gain. However, all of a sudden they issued huge amount of warrants and you get it. And you enjoy the huge gain. And all of a sudden, I thought I get gain, but because of the outcome of huge dilution, I couldn't get any gain. So that is what's happening. So that is what you are going to describe. I think this is really, you know, makes
less.
Sense.
You still get something. You get what is left.
Yeah. Get
that
something.
That is not measure. Only
but it depends on the system of our accounting system. We do not measure everything fair value. So
that's well done.
So if we were to do nothing in Approach A, then my plea would be to disclose the fair value of these other equity instruments, because that's the key bit of information missing. Investors can recreate all of this stuff, but the bit of information that's missing to do it is the fair value of the warrants and the options. So that would be my plea if we did A. I don't think we should do A, I think we should do C, but not precisely the way you've done it. For B, we've tried the basic ownership approach in the old FICE project and we moved away from it because nobody liked it. We tried exactly what you're proposing in 2008 in the earnings per share ED, which also failed. We because nobody liked it. So my prediction is if we try B again, it will fail. So don't do B. Approach C, effectively, the current diluted earnings per share is in substance an attribution, but it's an attribution based upon the relative intrinsic value of the option and the fair value of the equity. Mathematically, that's effectively what diluted earnings per share is. So we've already got it, but it's sort of hidden away. And the problem is the attribution is based upon an intrinsic value measure of the option, not the fair value, which is incomplete. So I think either change diluted earnings per share so that it's better, so that it's so the dilution is calculated to reflect the fair value of the option, not the intrinsic value. That would be one way of doing it. Or, better still, do the attribution that you're proposing, because then you get a consistency between the non-controlling interest and the options or all of these other equity items. You have an attribution to them. I understand what Sue says about it sort of doesn't quite seem to make a lot of sense with the respect to the options, or makes less sense than the non-controlling interest. But I think the benefit of consistency for the two outweighs the disadvantages. So I would do an attribution. I would then get rid of diluted earnings per share entirely, which would reduce the complexity of financial statements and would remove that confusion about which is the right earnings per share to use. But I don't think you've done the right calculation for C. So what you've done is this relative fair value, and it produces a change, and you're applying it to the underlying net assets. And I think there's a much simpler way of doing it, and you just take the relative fair values and you attribute earnings based upon the relative fair values of the different classes of equity, which is effectively what's done for diluted earnings per share, except it's based upon intrinsic value.
But would you do the end of period fair value, Steve? Well,
diluted earnings per share is based upon an average over the period, so I would do the same average.
The average ratio of fair values over the period.
That's detail.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah.
Daily fair values.
Daily fair value of warrants.
What happened to that guy yesterday who said that just because those ideas weren't accepted 5 years ago, we shouldn't come back and try them again?
But there's good ideas in that.
If you look at average, you do realize we are asking people to run warrant fair values on quite a regular basis. Because we are looking at including, which I do agree, the full fair value, not just the intrinsic.
You're finding sort of roadblocks in by picking on detail.
Broad strokes.
I have 30,000 feet so far.
But
Manuel's calculation is based upon a net assets number. Is that the daily average net assets or the year end net assets?
It's just the year end.
Well, okay, I'll do the year end value then.
Yeah.
If you're willing to accept that degree of approximation, I will as well.
Okay, a lot of simplification today. Very good. Gary?
Yep. Manuel, we'll start with your comment on paragraph 3, which says one way or the other, we need to provide this information. I completely agree. But I would prefer to do it through a footnote as opposed to EPS. One is EPS is complex on a good day. This whole discussion illustrates just how complex this whole subject is. But the premise of basic EPS was supposed to be simple. It's essentially net income divided by period end shares. Then you have fully diluted to load it up with all the potential conversions and puts and stuff like that. So if you're going to reopen basic, I mean, if we're not putting everything back in that used to be there, I mean, now you got another level of complication. What do you have stuff? You know, maybe it's not one of these. It's divided to be something else. And, you know, so you engineer something that doesn't have to go into basic, but logic says it probably should. I think we should keep EPS as simple as it is today, which isn't very simple. I also think, but why? But this only makes it worse. You know, it makes it more complicated. They got rid of, you know, primary or, you know, or whatever it is, because it was extremely complicated. Instrument after instrument, each individually sort of described and defined what to do with it. And so, if just these, why not some others? And I think that question comes. Actually, in North America, and I'll speak both Canada and the U.S., is there's almost no attention on BASIC. It's all in fully diluted. And so, if we're going to go that route, I think we probably need some research. Well, which EPS number gets the most attention in the marketplace? Now, sometimes it's not even so much the absolute number. It's the trend of the changes in numbers that's more important than perhaps the absolute. It so I would be a proponent of A. It, with footnotes, as we, and of B versus C, probably a slight preference towards C, you know, for the reasons other people have discussed.
But just a reminder, I mean, we aren't, the objective of this project isn't to change EPS. I mean, we're just trying to pick some already used concepts in the current requirements to see whether we can use them for the purposes of what we're trying to accomplish in terms of giving more information about items classified as equity. So once we come up with some proposals, we'd have to go back and think about what changes, if any, we'd make to EPS as a consequence of what we're proposing. But that is going to be separate to changing to proposing changes to EPS that would be unrelated to this project, because I think that would be a significant scope creep.
Yeah,
that will
simplify.
Martin, I have to say I'm confused with this paper, because I don't know really what we want to achieve. Is it really to really have this value transfer, or do we want to have this value transfer by really the attribution of which is a kind of distribution to anybody, and that is a kind of mean regarding what is the current P&L and what is, so I'm really quite confused by that. And based on all of that, because I think this is too complicated, I think we should, as Gary said, maybe do nothing regarding this kind of calculation, but maybe then what Stephen maybe has proposed gives a disclosure what people I need to make whatever calculations they want. Or secondly, what Steve has said, I think if it is really okay, we want to change the EPS, then we should change the EPS. But this, for me, is looking like a mixture of that. Yeah. And I don't know really what it is. I think, is it really kind of changing EPS? Because it is, my understanding, it is a little bit of changing EPS. What you are doing is you're looking at the profit for the year and looking, okay, based on outstanding derivatives, what is then the percentage of what people maybe in future years, because it's currently not exercised, would get for this? And for me, that is typically diluted EPS, but it's not really diluted EPS. So what is it? So I'm really struggling with that, and I'm confused. So I would really recommend, if you really want to have that, then we said maybe what Stephen has said, changing the diluted EPS calculation. Or if not, then I think what Gary has said, leave it as it is, the EPS, and then give additional disclosure. What investors maybe need for their own calculation of EPS. Because I understand, because based on my experience, everybody has his own EPS calculation. And when every investor has different things and different assumptions and to do us different things. So can we fulfill all that? I'm not sure.
Which means that the accounting doesn't work.
I would not say it doesn't work, but maybe they have different assumptions. What is really then exercised, what is not, and
Manya, the objective of this one is we have started with the differentiation between debt and equity.
Yeah.
So if that classification is not so enough, then we are going to have this kind of alternative means to provide some useful information.
I mean, starting from the top, we have a variety of claims against the entity. We're not going to show all the similarities and differences using one single distinction. And we said that from the beginning. We're going to explore other distinctions within liabilities and within equity to provide that information. And that was consistent with
calls that we had from users for more information about items with characteristics of both liabilities and equity to provide that information. And every time, many times when we've talked to users, they've always requested us their form of keeping it simple is to just classify the most residual claim as equity. And then just everything else is a liability. And that would result in the similar requirements as approach B. However, that also shifts other problems into the liability space, because in the liability space, you would then have all these items that would have all these characteristics that would be very equity-like, and then you start differentiating between them and talking about, would have all the problems about that we were trying to resolve in Agenda Paper 5A about the performance of the entity, etc., would be amplified, and we'd have to do additional requirements to try and differentiate those within them. At some point, we have to differentiate these things because they have different implications for the entity.
However, if we succeed in differentiating these two instruments, then you don't need a strong demand for this kind of alternative means. That's what I'm saying. Maybe people are suggesting we don't have to touch some EPS numbers. And
well, I think that this is a question of cost versus benefits, I think. Mm-hmm. I think we need to provide some information some way about these instruments. The question is, do we do it through sort of recognition, measurement, and presentation, or do we do it through additional disclosure of terms, other tabular disclosures, which include some other information, fair value information of these types of instruments. So it's just a question of the costs and benefits of how we provide the information.
Mary?
I think one lesson I take away from the discussion we've just had this afternoon is that if we want to get good input in response to a consultation, we've got to find a way to really simplify the questions we're asking. That's not to dumb it down in terms of how complex some of the things are, but if people get lost in terms of understanding what we're discussing, we won't get good feedback. I mean, and I think your point about, we've heard a lot, you know, the calls we've had for basic ownership approach suggests to us that it's because people want a lot of features to get recognition and measurement, and the only way they can think of doing that is classifying its liabilities so that you're forced to remeasure them, which then creates a host of other issues. So what we're trying to do is explore other ways to do it. And I think, you know, I look back at paper 5, and you have a section on what financial reporting challenges were identified, but that's more the problems that exist today. And I think I would head up this whole section by saying, what have we heard and what calls are we trying to respond to? I think what we've heard is that users want more information about dilution and participation rights. And so what we're trying to do is explore ways of providing them with that information. Now, approach A is a disclosure-based response to that. And is there a way to do it? Is it just data about characteristics? Or is there a more usable format to put it into that will give people the data they need if they want to recalculate, but makes the entity who is perhaps better placed try and present some of the effects of understanding these instruments and not wading through the legal documents.
Yeah.
One way, you know, Gary talked about terms and conditions or EPS. One way that we could maybe try, you know, say, would it help, basically this is approach A, would it help if we mandated publications of the working of diluted EPS? Because I just took another look. Right now, IAS 33 requires disclosure of a lot of items, but it doesn't say show the workings. And in some ways, the workings might give some users the data they need to make the adjustments that they think are appropriate, whether it's for a different estimate, et cetera. That, I'm not advocating that, but I think that's maybe another specific we could put under A. A second thing about making it simple is I think in terms of B versus C, we should pick one and do the singing and dancing, maybe not all singing and dancing version, but people will die if we give them two, you know, if we give them all of B and all of C. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to pick one and then have some discussion of how the other approach would differ. My concern about C which originally had driven me towards B, but now I'm uncertain about that. My concern about C is that it feels much more like this is a calculated number rather than it represents something. But I think the heading, and I think we have to think about that. My problem with approach, with the characterization or discussion of approach B, if I look at paragraph 28 in the heading, it sends the message, I mean, I think somebody could walk away with the incorrect impression that we're having a discussion about really pumping up the population that's required to be measured at fair value.
Yeah.
And that's not what this discussion is about. It's saying we want to attribute, recognize, comprehensive income.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to think about is different bases for doing that. Should it just be the EPS mechanics? It may be flawed. It may be, as Steve pointed out, apples and oranges because it's intrinsic and fair value. But at least people have pretty much got their heads around it. Or should it be something that tries to do an allocation? If so, what basis? Because I don't want people to take away, we're going to try and solve this with fair value measurement. That's just a mechanic for trying to get to an objective of showing allocation. And I think we have to relate it back to the context of what we're trying to do. I think we have done an all singing, all dancing version, and I think it's of B, when we did the conceptual framework discussion paper. And there's the piece in the back that made everybody wobbly about this expanded statement of equity, and I think it sent people running for the hills. It's the kind of thing you have to work through several times, but you see what you're in that, because there are several different types of instruments. If you followed it, worked through, what you could see is we're saying, how much did the warrant holders benefit at the cost of the holders of the common shares? So I think we have to find one version, do that, and then talk about how the others might be different rather than try to load it up. But the last thing I will put in is, if we're talking about some of the stuff that's in here, I think it would alter the basic EPS calculation. I mean, that's the implication. And I'll kind of police the cop on this, saying, remember, EPS is, I think, a converged calculation. So we just would have to
Not really.
On different profit numbers.
Loads of differences.
But really or really not?
We tried to converge and we...
It's not really.
No. I thought basic was, at least.
As
soon as you've got any sort of, you know, shares that are put or anything like that, they've got guidance we don't have.
I wasn't saying don't do it because of that. I was just saying I think we have to think about that question, and if there is some impact on that, flag up that this is a consideration from a cost benefit concern that we'd have to weigh.
Well, I would say in the discussion paper put all of these in and talk about the pros and cons that the board has just walked through. I've certainly been persuaded, based on today's discussions, among others, that the best way to go here to deliver a high quality kind of package of information is approach A. I say that from a simplicity standpoint, less controversial, some of the points that Martin and Gary have raised. One of the observations, you know, that Steve made in terms of, you know, what we tried in the past and is unlikely to you know, succeed again. In my heart of hearts, my druthers, I prefer B, but I agree it's not gonna go forward. So put them all in there, discuss them, but approach A is the most pragmatic. And I think it delivers what you've been talking about this project is about, which is you can't get all the information you want from the balance sheet or the P&L. You're going to need some disclosures. And if you provide it in there, people actually, if you ask the companies to do the calculation, it'll be there for them as opposed to just giving them the information to do the calculation. So that's something else we can consider.
I didn't hear a lot of support for approach B. So in the interest of the discussion paper, if we present less approaches rather than more, do we want to... Oh, sorry, I think Peter wants to.
I mean, I've got a problem with approach C because it just looks like a calculation. I can't see what the number will tell anybody. Right. And that also goes for Steve's variant as well. So if I had a vote, I wouldn't include approach C unless we can come up with a description of what the number means.
Peter, in approach B, one element represents, one element of the allocation represents something, but the other one is a calculation.
I understand the flaws of B, and I understand, you know, I can see the pros and cons of B, but also there's the number is telling you something, but I can't see in C what the number is telling you.
Yeah, I agree, there is a flaw in C, just that.
I think it's a fatal flaw.
At B, it tells you something for one element, another.
I can understand what the carrying amount means in B, but this idea that in theory you could have an amount attributed to the warrants that's bigger than income.
Well,
to the warrants, and then you'd be being paid by the ordinary shareholders.
That's because we don't recognise all assets, and we don't measure them all at fair value.
But all of the criticism we've got for things like putable shares,
I agree with you. That's why I would go with A as well.
Mismatch.
But the theory behind it is not flawed.
No,
unlike approach C, where
there isn't a theory in C. I think it's just a calculation.
Yeah. Can I just come in?
I think just because we are putting that thing into fair value doesn't change the fact that it is still a calculation which we're doing in an allocation where the number after allocated, as Philip pointed out, and also Manuel said.
You're talking about B, right?
B, yeah. Completely exacerbates the problem that we are trying to solve in 5A, is that I'd have incomplete recognition. So I don't think, just because I can't explain it, the total allocation gives any more information. So C, by putting a cap or a floor on that incompleteness, I think also gives the information on relative terms. So I wouldn't say that it does not give any information.
But what does that mean? You see, in B, the number you've allocated, that fair value change itself has some independent meaning. So that's going to convey some information. But the allocated number in C is not going to tell you anything.
When I said I think we should pick one and build it out, I did not mean that we should entirely, per discussion paper, drop the other one from consideration. I think it's just don't overload people with how much data we give them. And so, you know, if it's a discussion paper, you know, maybe we can come up with a better variant of B or a better variant of C. But I think it's pick one, build it out, and then discuss how the other or others would differ from it briefly.
Okay.
Kind of the way we said we're going to focus on gamma, and then we'll have discussion of you get different answers under alpha or beta.
Would the board be happy with that approach?
Say it again. What is that approach?
So we'll pick one of these approaches. It could be B or C. And
B prime, maybe, or C prime, given some, you know, Steve said.
And we look at variations of that one approach as opposed to having three separate approaches. So approach A is kind of like the status quo.
We're going to
think about disclosures regardless of the approaches. So we're going to think about disclosure at some future point in time. But in terms of the attribution requirements, approach A just keeps the status quo. And what we'll present is another approach which has two variations, and one is going to be an approach based, well, one variation is going to be fair value and the other variation is going to be a calculation based on fair value.
And is this B or C? And who's going to decide?
We're putting both in, but
which good ideas and there's bad ideas.
Do we want to take a decision which one you prefer to include?
I think you may need it to do. I think you may need to go away. Think about what you've heard. This is our first pass through all of this, and it's a pretty ugly moving thing. And then come back with a more specific suggestion. Not a let's think about it from ground zero.
Let's not decide on the fly.
Yeah.
Given this discussion, it is very unlikely that you will be able to come up with a solution that 90% of the world will say, this is fantastic, let's go. And that's why I think however we present it, I know that we're still going to do disclosures, but that you have to make clear an alternative is the present situation,
yes.
but with much extended disclosure.
Okay. And we could, yeah, we could disclose the fair value of that equity bit, which would not be recognized as fair value, but we disclose that fair value.
Yeah, that's what Steve suggested.
But I think then we have to go back for approach A and say, what problem are we trying to solve, and what information have people told us they need? So it's not just disclose a lot; it's provide the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not more disclosures, better disclosures.
More